Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight we're talking about life in San Francisco's Tenderloin and two nonprofits that are working to improve the neighborhood. And later in the hour, my co-host Ethan Elkind interviews Aaron Gleason, who has written a new cookbook, The Forest Feast Road Trip. But first, let's talk transit. Nearly 30 years ago, city planners had a dream, and that dream was that Van Ness Avenue could be a fast transit corridor. And on April 1st, that dream became a reality with the grand opening of the Van Ness Rapid Transit Project. It took 7 years. It went $40 billion over budget. It was subject to a grand jury investigation. But that two-mile bus lane is finally open, and joining us to tell us more is Jeffrey Tumlin, the executive director of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Jeff.
Thanks, Grace. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm excited about Van Ness. I drove Van Ness. I'm sorry I didn't get on a bus on Sunday just to see what it was like. But for our listeners who have not seen it, tell us a little bit about what the rapid transit lines on Van Ness are supposed to do.
Well, so Van Ness is part of US 101 and is one of the highest trafficked arterials in San Francisco. It has three traffic lanes. And what we did is we took the inside traffic lanes and made them for buses and emergency vehicles only, and also gave them a new busway that is dyed bright red. It's literally rolling out the red carpet for transit. And in addition, we replaced all of the decrepit infrastructure, both below the ground and above the ground. So there's new lights, there's 375 new trees, there's 4,000 new shrubs. And after way too many years of construction, the street looks much better.
Well, I think you just acknowledged that there was infrastructure above ground and below ground, and that kind of suggests why the project did go so long and was over budget. But tell us a little bit about why it took so long, because the project did get this rap of being Van Mess, as it was, were, and, you know, it took so long, and people were a little bit frustrated and maybe even losing hope.
Yes. Well, we call this the Van Ness Bus Rapid Transit Project, but that's really only about 15% of the budget. The project itself is mainly underground. Van Ness, being one of the oldest, biggest streets in the city, was full of 19th century utilities, most of which were not mapped, and all of which were in varying states of decrepitude. So the project dug up the entire street and replaced all of the utilities, all of the brick sewers from the mid-19th century, all of the water lines and emergency water system from the late 19th century, defunct telecommunication lines from telecoms that went out of business decades ago. We had no way of knowing which of these lines were live gas lines or abandoned 19th century lines from the gas streetlights that were there at the end of the 19th century. Unsnarling all of that while trying to keep traffic moving ended up being a greater challenge than most of us anticipated. And we're so sorry to the commuters and business owners and residents along the street for the added travel time and construction time that the project took.
Well, you mentioned business owners, and there was an inability to park on Van Ness. It was much harder to reach businesses along Van Ness. Did the city offer any compensation to those businesses during the time of construction or concessions?
Yeah, so Van Ness was one of the first projects where the city tested providing direct compensation and other services to businesses impacted by significant construction. So we partnered with the Mayor's Office of Economic and Workforce Development in order to give grants and other reimbursements to businesses that were impacted by construction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know as the executive director of Muni, you're uniquely focused on buses. But if you're driving a car down Van Ness, what should you expect?
So one of the benefits of the Van Ness busway is it gets the buses out of traffic. So the buses are no longer merging in and out of traffic in order to pick up and drop off passengers at the sidewalk. Instead, the buses are in the center and moving straight, and you don't ever have to worry about a bus driving in front of you. So while one of the lanes is bus only, the other two lanes seem to be operating more smoothly because there's less of this erratic merging in and out of traffic. So Van Ness is still one of the most important arterials for carrying car traffic, but now it works a lot better for emergency services and for transit. And as a result of that, Van Ness can move more people than it has historically.
Well, and I think most people know this, but you can't make a left turn on Van Ness anymore.
That's right. Plan ahead. Use Franklin and Goff. There's plenty of ways to turn left in San Francisco. And, you know, two rights may not make a wrong, but, you know, three rights will make a left.
Well, you know, we needed a dad joke in there. Well, in order to make that April 1st ribbon cutting deadline, did you guys have to do anything to speed up the project to get it across the finish line? Or was that just set solid? You knew you were going to make April 1?
We were very confident that we were going to make April 1. And we're actually really grateful to our partners with the Federal Transit Administration that recognized that the busway is not that exotic. You know, we've been operating in transit-only lanes in San Francisco for 100 years, and we were just moving the bus from the number three lane to the number one lane. And so we were able to significantly shorten the testing time because we all realized that that the busway was going to be safer and more effective than the curbside operations. And so federal government, the Federal Transit Administration, helped to accelerate our approval for starting up service. And we've also kind of learned a lot together along the way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are the lines that go down Van Ness, and how long roughly would it take to get from Market to, I guess it ends at Bay, that transit corridor?
Yeah, well, it used to vary dramatically depending upon how much congestion there was on Van Ness. And pre-COVID, Van Ness got really, really jammed. It could take well over half an hour to get from one end of the corridor to the other. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing travel times just under 14 minutes, and in some cases a little bit better than that. We're still tinkering with the signal timing. Right now, I think we had actually underestimated the ridership on the line. And so we're having to accommodate a little bit longer to make sure the passengers can get on and off the bus and still hit the wave of green lights.
Well, you were mentioning the ridership. It seems like this is a popular bus line, but Muni ridership has not come back to pre-pandemic levels. What are you all doing to boost ridership numbers? And when could we expect, you know, all the lines to come back?
So right now, what we're seeing in San Francisco is a very slow rate of return to office. In fact, San Francisco has the slowest rate of return to downtown office of any city in the world, largely because it's a financial services and technology economy. So lines that go to the financial district have low ridership, but lines that don't are actually, in some cases, exceeding their pre-COVID ridership. Lines like the 22 Fillmore on weekends is getting close to 120% of pre-COVID ridership. What we've seen in San Francisco is the geography of essential workers. Our transit ridership in our neighborhood commercial districts and to our essential institutions like the hospitals, basically approaching pre-COVID ridership. It's just the financial district that is lagging, and we're expecting that the financial district ridership will increase as employers figure out how much office space do they really need. We're guessing that office rents will drop, and people who were pushed out of downtown San Francisco in the last economic upcycle will come back into downtown. And so eventually all Muni ridership will come back. What we're doing right now is taking our one-time federal funding in order to invest in improved transit service. So providing better frequency and reliability on our main lines, continuing to invest in nearly the same levels of cleaning that we did from the early days of COVID, and providing better speed and reliability on key corridors, and particularly in the subway. Mm-hmm. What we found is that where we've invested in speed and reliability and cleanliness and better service, that the ridership is there. And I think, again, the 22 Fillmore is the best example. Mm-hmm. So we're continuing as we hire new operators to infill frequency where it's lost and expand service back to closer to where it was pre-COVID. But right now we have 1,000 vacancies at the SFMTA.
Wow.
And if you're looking for a great job with a career ladder, just Google SFMTA jobs. We're hiring in every job category.
Wow. 1,000 job openings. That's incredible. Well, I'm struck by the fact that in doing some research for this show, that the idea of, you know, making Van Ness this rapid transit corridor, it's almost 30 years old. It was conceived in 1995. And, you know, at that time, there were no electric vehicles, there was no Uber, there was no Lyft. How do you make these transportation plans that, you know, were conceived decades ago still relevant for the time that we're living in? I mean, are these bus lines still relevant?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what is important here in California is to recognize that our state highway system, those roads are not getting any wider. We're no longer demolishing neighborhoods in order to widen highways. And so our challenge here in California is to manage our streets in order to allow them to move more people and to prioritize people who have the fewest mobility choices. So we're very proud of our partnership with Caltrans and the Federal Highway Administration for taking a street like Van Ness and changing it so that we can move more people. Buses can move 10 times as many people per square foot of roadway. Then we can move people in private cars, in autonomous vehicles, and Uber or Lyft. And so the game of urban mobility is always about space efficiency and equity. Mm. And that's our task. And there are few more cost-effective ways of achieving that than prioritizing bus transit and also learning from some of our mistakes. So right. Even as we've struggled with the schedule delays on Van Ness, we've moved forward with transit-only lanes in Geary that have gone from project conception into completion in less than 12 months. And that's exactly what we're working on right now from Stanyan out to 35th Avenue is an expansion of the Geary transit-only lanes that have shown the ability to dramatically expand speed and reliability on our highest ridership line at about a tenth the cost and about a tenth of the timeline as major construction projects like Van Ness.
Well, could you – you mentioned Geary, and I wanted to ask about that. So you were saying that between Stanyan and out in the avenues, you're adding another rapid transit lane. Did I understand that correctly?
That's right. We've already completed most of the work from Stanyan all the way to the Transbay Transit Center downtown.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to prioritize the 38 Geary and the entire length of the corridor.
Mm-hmm. And is it going to be similar to what's happening on Van Ness with a center bus corridor, or is it going to look something different?
Very different. So part of the problem here in San Francisco is we have a policy that's called Dig Once. And if we wanted to redo the median of Geary, it then triggers the replacement and upgrading of underground utilities.
Which is what you had in Van Ness, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we've learned that lesson. We've realized that side-running transit-only lanes are not quite as effective as median transit-only lanes, but we're getting at least 80% of the benefit, and that's coming at 90% less cost. So what we're doing is moving forward very quickly. The other thing that we've learned is that doing what we call quick build, which is using simple techniques like plastic posts and a lot of paint and simple engineering, that it's a very effective way of testing design and tinkering with the design until we get it right. And then once we do get it right, going and investing and putting all that in place in concrete. It's also helped us to build trust in the community so that we can move more nimbly. And we've also found that some of our ideas actually didn't make any sense, and we've undone them and gone back to the drawing board. We love this quick build approach here in San Francisco, and it's allowing us to more than double our project delivery capacity.
Well, what's an idea that you thought was going to work but didn't end up working? And you mentioned that you took it off the drawing board. What? Give us a sample of that.
Yeah, so I think we have a lot of examples of that in our Slow Streets program. During COVID, like many cities, we put in 45 miles of Slow Streets. They were all experimental, using cheap, nothing materials. And some of them didn't work at all, and we've undone them. And others have been wildly successful, not only helping people to, you know, take care of their socially distanced exercise, but also attracting people on foot and on bikes and on scooters of all ages and abilities. It never occurred to me that slow streets would allow people with visual impairment to be able to get exercise effectively because of the much clearer contrast that people with visual impairment were seeing on our slow streets. Hmm. It didn't occur to us that parents would organize biking school buses to get from some of the outermost neighborhoods into the core of the city because it allowed eight-year-olds to feel safe biking across San Francisco. Mm. None of this would have happened if we had gone through conventional planning process.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say to people who feel that San Francisco is not car friendly and they need their car? You know, they have disabilities or they have children or there are reasons why they are in a car. Do you have a response to those residents?
Yes.
And visitors?
Absolutely. Many San Franciscans will always need a car in order to fully partake in the city. And there are many, many reasons for that. And we recognize and support all those reasons. But as the city grows, in order for the mobility system to continue to work, we need to make sure that not everyone is forced into being in a car, because if they are, then no one can move anywhere. Mm. So what we're doing is tinkering around the edges in the mobility system so that people who want to walk or bike or take a scooter or use transit, that those modes are possible. And we like those modes not because they're morally superior. We like those modes because they're geometrically much more efficient. Again, mm. I can move 10 times as many people per square foot of roadway on a bike or on a scooter or on a bus than I can if those people are in cars. And so while driving a car may be essential for some people, the best way to make it possible for those people to drive who need to drive mm-hmm. is to make it more attractive for some other people not to be driving in front of them.
Right, right. Well, before I let you go, a final question. It's the third rail of transportation in the city, and that would be the Central Subway. When is that going to open and commence service?
We are still on schedule for opening this fall. Over the weekend, we just connected the overhead line from the 3rd Street into the Central Subway. So we'll be able to run trains straight from 3rd Street into the subway. We've been testing all the systems, running trains back and forth among the 3 subway stations and surface station. And so far, it looks like everything is going well. There still is a punch list of items that should be completed in the coming months. And we so look forward to that project finally being done as well. And again, we're very, very, very grateful, particularly to the people of Chinatown, whose businesses were disrupted on Stockton Street as a result of that construction.
Well, I certainly hope there'll be another grand opening in 2022 for you, Jeffrey Tumlin.
Oh, there's going to be an even bigger party for Central Subway.
Well, we'll look forward to it. And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Jeffrey Tumlin. He's the executive director of the San Francisco Municipal Transit Agency, fondly known here as MUNI. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Dr. Lena Miller of Urban Alchemy and Christy Shirilla about their work in San Francisco's Tenderloin neighborhood. That's right after the break. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. The Tenderloin grabs its fair share of local and national headlines for its seemingly intractable issues of poverty, homelessness, violence, and drug dealing. Last year, Mayor London Breed brought in community ambassadors to the Tenderloin and increased the number of police officers in the area. In December, she declared a 90-day emergency in the Tenderloin to address overdose deaths. She also opened a service linkage center to connect people on the streets to housing and treatment. While Breed's emergency order expired in March, the linkage center and community ambassadors program remain in place. And tonight, we're taking a deeper look into this 40-square block neighborhood in the heart of San Francisco. It's more than an assortment of problems. It's a diverse, tight-knit community filled with families, small businesses, churches, and schools. And with us to talk about the Tenderloin and some of the nonprofits helping to make it better is Christy Shirilla. She's the Director of Community Organizing and a resident voice for the Tenderloin Community Benefit District. It's also called TLCD for short. Christy, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Dr. Lena Miller. She's the founder and CEO of Urban Alchemy, a local nonprofit focused on the Tenderloin and south of Market. Welcome to State of the Bay, Lena Miller.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great. We want our listeners to be part of the next this next conversation. We're talking about efforts to bring the community feel to the Tenderloin. Do you live or work in the Tenderloin, and do you have thoughts on what might make it better? And what do you think about the barriers there are to work in what do you think the barriers are to work these organizations are doing in the Tenderloin? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay, or email us. We're at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Christy, I wanted to start with you. There are so many stereotypes and misconceptions about the Tenderloin. People and politicians seem to refer it to more as a problem to be solved than a place that people live. And I know you live there. So first, tell us what the boundaries of the neighborhood are, and then tell us about the community from your perspective as a resident.
Sure. And I just want to make sure I'm very transparent. I moved out of the neighborhood a few months ago, but I did live there for about 6 years.
Okay, great. Thank you for letting us know.
Yeah. And the boundaries are on the west. The CBD boundaries are on the west, Van Ness, on the north, Geary, Mason on the east, and then Market is our southern boundary.
Mm-hmm. And what is the community like? If you live in the Tenderloin and you have a family, what's that like for you?
You know, I've lived in San Francisco for about 16 years, and I never felt like I lived in more of a neighborhood than when I lived in the Tenderloin. I knew all of my neighbors. We took care of each other. They're still taking care of each other, even though I'm not there.
Yeah.
But you know, it's really tough to raise a family. I did not have to raise a family. But I work really closely with many people who did. I have a lot of friends raising families in the neighborhood. And it's tough. It's really hard to just, you know, get your kids to school safely or do your laundry. But aside from that, it is a beautiful community, very diverse. And I really did love living in the Tenderloin, and I miss being there.
Well, I was walking through there the other day, and I was amazed by just like the variety of restaurants and different kinds of food you could get at the cafes. I think that on the media, we just see people who are unhoused, but there were lots of kids around.
Yeah, I don't think that people realize, people in the rest of the city realize that the Tenderloin has the highest per capita amount of children. We have an estimated 3,500, but that estimate is from the 2010 census. So I think it's actually quite a bit higher than that. It is a family neighborhood. Yeah, it really is.
Mm-hmm. I think I heard a really stunning fact that there are more children per square block in the Tenderloin than in any other neighborhood in the United States, which kind of speaks to what you were just noting. So, Christy, tell us about the work of the Tenderloin Community Benefit District, and what is it? Is it a nonprofit? Is it run by the government? Is it run by the city? Give us a little feel for what it is and how it works in the Tenderloin.
Yeah, so Community Benefit District is created and voted on by really property owners, and then a tax is levied to fund improvements in the neighborhood. So it's a private public partnership. It is a nonprofit, and our overall goal is to improve quality of life for people in the Tenderloin, families, children, seniors, small businesses. We work sort of in three buckets. We have neighborhood pride, clean economic opportunity, and also inviting space. So our economic opportunity, they help small businesses apply for debt relief grants or grants for, you know, business improvements. They kind of help businesses advocate for their needs, whether it's safety or you know, drawing in more business. Inviting space really focuses on our park network. We have three parks in the Tenderloin, and our inviting space in the Tenderloin, the parks are stewarded, and they sort of need to be stewarded just for safety and cleanliness and making sure that kids and families and seniors who use the park have a safe experience. We have our Safe Passage, which serves about 1,100 kids daily, helping kids get to school safely, and about 670 seniors every day, helping seniors get to their senior center or whatever activities they need to get to. And then, which I'm the director of Neighborhood Pride, and that is our resident voice and also our Youth Voice. We have a Youth Voice Fellowship, and then with Resident Voice, I facilitate 5 Black groups and support an additional 2 Black groups that I don't facilitate directly, but a lot of the ideas that come out of the Black groups from the residents are the ideas that we then use to try to help create some physical improvements in the neighborhood.
Oh, that's great. And what's an idea that you've heard from your Block groups that you've tried to implement?
So one of the most successful was Director Tumlin was just talking about slow streets, and the Tenderloin was actually never approved for a slow street. Mm. And our residents were so cooped up during COVID.
They're
in small apartments, mm-hmm. sometimes studios or one bedroom apartment with multi-generational families in one apartment. And so people were just very cooped up, and we came up with an idea. There's a permanent supportive housing site on the 200 block of Turk. That's mostly family housing. Mm-hmm. And we created a Safe Passage Park, and it's right along the Safe Passage route. And it was an extended parklet essentially. And it mm-hmm. has planters, and it has, there's programming through Salvation Army there across the street. So the Croc Center comes and we'll do Tai Chi or gentle movement, or other, like sometimes there's free books. There's just different activations, and it's really changed the block. And we actually, it's been a great collaboration with Urban Alchemy and Doc Lena Miller, because they've helped steward the space and make sure that it stays calm and safe for residents.
Well, I want to bring Dr. Lena Miller in to talk about that. Dr. Miller, you're the CEO of the nonprofit Urban Alchemy, and you're a partner to the Benefit District, as Christy just noted. So tell us a little bit, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, what the work of Urban Alchemy is.
Well, Urban Alchemy, we are a nonprofit social enterprise. We prioritize hiring former long-term offenders or returning citizens. That's people who once had a life sentence in prison, who did the work and were released, or other people with life experiences that give them a very attuned sense of emotional intelligence. And really where we focus our work is on chaotic spaces, to bring a sense of calm to those spaces. And so we do a number of things. Our work tends to fall in 4 areas. There's sanitation and cleanliness. So we do street cleaning, primarily in Los Angeles. We used to do it in the Tenderloin, but now we don't, but we're all over LA. Mobile hygiene programs, toilets, showers. Again, we used to do the Pit Stop program in San Francisco, but we still do that in LA in showers. Residential, which is the safe sleep villages, VTCs, where people are living in their cars, the tiny homes, or the small cabins in San Francisco, tiny homes in Los Angeles. And then safety and activation, which is the work that our people do, or engagement, safety and activation, the work that we do in the Tenderloin and mid-market. Yeah.
Well, in the Tenderloin, I believe Mayor Breed brought your group in to help clean the streets and, you know, make them safer for residents and visitors to the neighborhood. How has that been going for your, I think you call your employees practitioners. What has that experience been like for them?
You know, it's hard, right? Mm. I mean, there's a lot of issues in the Tenderloin. We get some kind of, you know, there's some pictures that's been in the newspapers, and there's a lot of, you know, poverty porn that we see. But I mean, it's rough day to day, but I also think it's extremely rewarding. You know, as she said before, it's a tight-knit community. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of community. There's a lot of people looking out for each other. But there's also a lot of, you know, despair, distress, you know, people who are suffering. And I think it's hard for our practitioners, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's not, we do a great, they do a great job, but it's not free to us. Right. You know, it takes a toll. So,
yeah. Well, I want to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan. We're discussing life in the Tenderloin with Dr. Lena Miller. She's the CEO of Urban Alchemy. And we also have Christy Cirillo. She's the Director of Community Organizing for the Tenderloin Community Benefit District, also called the TLCD. Are you a resident of the Tenderloin or a business owner? Is the current approach to the Tenderloin enough? You can join our program by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. I want to go to the phones. We've got Rudy from San Francisco on the line. Welcome to State of the Bay, Rudy.
Oh, thank you for having me. Hey, how you doing, Lena and Cindy?
Hello.
I want to commend you guys on the work you're doing. So I'm a resident and born and raised in District 6, which is actually the TL, South of Market, Treasure Island, and Soma Bay, but grew up primarily in the Tenderloin area in the South of Market. And I just have to give really props to Lena and the Urban Alchemy team, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, for the phenomenal job they do to keep people safe. See, a lot of people don't see the work that they do and how many lives they save under the radar. When nobody's there, their staff is there. This dude's out there who I've literally seen bring people back to life when they OD. I'm talking about mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Not even with Narcan.
Right.
Right? I'm talking about guys who used to be in a lifestyle that used to take life, but now are saving lives. And Urban Alchemy, I'm telling you, man, has so many, saved so many lives that people probably is countless that people don't see that go under the radar. Dudes out there like Everett Butler, Lou, Ian, Artie, and many other guys out there who are frontline soldiers that people don't see on a day-to-day that Lena has on her team. Mm-hmm. They are really heroes, practitioners. These dudes, man, I swear to you, and they got girls out there that does miracles. I know, I'm from the TL, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you
know, I
know. Ain't nothing tender about the loin. For real, it ain't.
Well,
but
really,
they got beautiful family.
I want to ask you a question, Rudy, since you grew up there, you're very familiar with it. What has Urban Alchemy done? I mean, lots of people have tried to, quote unquote, solve the Tenderloin. But what has Urban Alchemy done that hasn't been done before? And what's making what makes them different and distinctive and successful, in your opinion?
So I'm going to tell you, when you got situations like, just say if your car broke down, right? You got to take your car to a mechanic. You're not going to take your car to see a dentist. But when you have people who's been in crisis and has post-traumatic stress disorders, you have to get somebody who knows how to deal with people with those issues. And that's what Urban Alchemy brings. That's the difference. They are out there saving many, that's what I say, they save so many lives, and they talk to people. Their best gift is know how to be people persons and how to give people and bring life to a hopeless situation. Because everybody know the Tenderloin was one big-ass toilet ready to be flushed. You know what I mean? And then when you got organizations up there like Cindy's organization and Lena M.M. and many other organizations out there that care about the people. See, there's a big population of Filipinos, Cambodians, and Vietnamese out there that people don't see.
Right.
Amongst all everything else mixed up in there.
Well,
but
Rudy,
they got somebody who knows how to deal with everybody out there.
Yeah, well, Rudy, thank you so much for calling State of the Bay. And I mean, you sound like a big fan of Urban Alchemy, and that's just great. So thanks very much for calling. Christy, I wanted to kind of take the tail of Rudy's comment. I mean, he seems very satisfied with how Urban Alchemy is working. What are you hearing from your constituents about what's happened since the mayor's emergency order went into place? And now that it's been dissolved, you know, are there concerns that things might go back to the way they were before, or are the changes here to stay?
It's been kind of a mixed response. The Department of Emergency Management and Human Rights Commission have been holding listening sessions with the community. And a few of them have been with the block groups I facilitate. And I think it kind of depends. What's interesting is, honestly, depending where you are in the neighborhood and whether or not Urban Alchemy is on your block has kind of decided whether or not the emergency declaration has been successful. The residents, particularly with my block groups, are mostly really happy with the way things have gone. The one group that does not have Urban Alchemy was really, you know, asking for them at the beginning. But then there was just a really focused effort by Department of Emergency Management to help get the folks who had started in camping or, you know, really camping on that sidewalk or some of the folks who had been addicted were like, one of the big issues was the drug use on that particular block. It was right by a senior center that had physical therapy studio in the front, and they would leave their windows open for ventilation, but then they would get a lot of secondhand drug smoke. But the city, through this effort, really this sustained, consistent effort, has done a great job of being able to help get the folks there that needed help. Mm-hmm. There are a few other blocks that are still like what the city is calling hotspots, with a lot of really the big issue that the residents are upset about is the open air drug dealing. So that is still definitely an issue in some spots. But I think especially during the day, the neighborhood is, from when it started, there's a major improvement. And we're hearing that from residents, especially during the daytime.
Yeah. And there was an article recently in the Chronicle just about the difference between day and night in the Tenderloin. The article noted that by 7 p.m., most Urban Alchemy ambassadors go home. The Linkage Center closes at 8. And the 20 extra police officers who were added a few weeks ago, they leave by 9:30. So that there's a different vibe at nighttime in the Tenderloin. Lena Miller, what do you think needs to be done at night to make the area safer?
Well, I mean, I think we need a lot more resources. It's hard. Let me say this first, because when I was interviewed by the Chronicle, one of the things I said about this is we have to celebrate our wins. Mm-hmm. I remember when you couldn't walk down the street during the day without 40 or 50 people, you know, selling drugs, using drugs, all those kinds of things, you know, harassing people, just everything on every single block during the day. And then we made sure that certain blocks were clear, and women and children and people with disabilities and who felt vulnerable could walk down the street. And it was like, hurrah, you know, they never thought like Turk and Hyde could be, you know, cleared for people to walk down. And now everyone, oh, well, look at it at night. It's a mess. Like, golly, do you know how hard it was to do this? Can we just celebrate that we can do it in the day? And I mean, this stuff, the general public really doesn't understand what goes on or why it's so difficult. And because a lot of this is law enforcement issues, you really can't talk about it openly, but you can look down there and see what's happening. So while I understand that people are frustrated and they want it to all go away, and we do too, you know, it's extremely complicated and it's deep. You know, when we talk about open air drug sales, you look down there and watch what's happening. There's a lot of money to be made, or people are making a lot of money. You can't just go in there and say, hey, everybody, in the name of the law, stop. Or in the name of the, you know, it doesn't work that way. And so I think it, like I said, it was a tremendous effort just getting the streets clear during the day. And it takes time. And we need to be patient with the people who are not just standing on the sideline saying what they think it should be or giving an opinion, but who are actually getting in there, getting their hands and feet dirty and dealing with the stuff, you know. Yeah, support us to do that. And then I think then we can move on to the next phase and the next phase. But you know, let us breathe a little bit.
Oh, Dr. Miller, do you think that the emergency order should have been extended? Are you disappointed that it wasn't?
I don't want to say, you know, disappointed, because I think when we're, you know, like I said, we're in this. So everything, we're watching the ball constantly. I don't have time to be, you know, sitting around, oh, the mayor should have done this, the mayor should have done that, because we're in the game, right? Yes, I would like it extended further, and we would like more resources in the Tenderloin, because what's going on is completely unacceptable. You know, but at this point, I'll take what I can get and just keep pushing for the wins. And hopefully people can, you will say, we'll never go back. We'll never go back to what it was.
Right.
And yeah.
Yeah. Well, Christy Schirillo, what do you think about that? Are you disappointed that the order wasn't extended? Should it be?
Well, it's actually, even though that the emergency order has officially ended, Department of Emergency Management is not stopping operations until the end of June. So when the emergency order expired, that just meant that things like the city couldn't acquire more real estate like they did with the Linkage Center, or hire as quickly like they hired, I think, hundreds of people through DPH, therapists and caseworkers. I might want to fact check me on that, but it was like an astronomical number. So the actual operations are continuing through June. So there's a little bit of a misconception. Like, I think that the public didn't really understand that the operations are still happening.
Well, that's good to hear. And I mean, we're focused a lot on urban alchemy. And I just had another question for you, Dr. Miller. I mean, there have been some complaints or criticisms of urban alchemy that, you know, essentially what they're doing is moving people from one trouble spot to another trouble spot, and they're just moving people and not doing much beyond that. What do you say to critics of the program who are concerned that it's more of a bandage than it is really something that's improving the lives of residents in the Tenderloin?
Well, I think you heard from Christy, who said that for people who can walk down their street now, they don't feel like it's a bandage. They feel like their whole quality of life has changed. And because there are so many blocks that people can freely and safely walk down, I mean, we've watched people come out of their houses the first day, you know, we've had a block clean and clear, and literally dance down the street. Like, I can walk outside. I mean, it was bad. I think you'd have to talk to the folks who live there. And that's not what we're hearing from people. We're hearing that for the first time, they feel safe in their neighborhood, that they can walk down the street without being harassed. And so, okay, so let's for argument's sake say, well, it's a bandage, but it's not really getting to the root of the problem. I would say, yeah, you're right. You know, but really, is urban alchemy going to stop, you know, drug dealers? And come on, we're not law enforcement, right? We're doing what we're supposed to do, which is to create safe spaces for people to be, through engagement and relationships and talking to people and insisting that there are standards that people need to abide by in a society where we all live together, and reminding people of that. But are we going to get to the root of drugs selling fentanyl in San Francisco? That's not even, like, people must think that we're pretty powerful if they feel like we're letting the city down because we're not getting to the root of the problem. But in terms of day-to-day quality of life, I feel very confident to say that we've gone above and beyond to transform the areas that we're in. Every area that we're in, from Halliday Plaza and Civic Center and now UN Plaza and all these places that no one can get their hands around, we've been showing results. So, you know, we'd have to ask for a lot more money if we were able to get to the root of drug addiction, you know.
Yeah, I mean, these are tough problems. And I mean, Christy, I was reading that the Community Benefit District spends something like $3 million a year to just power wash the streets. I mean, do you ever feel like you're not making a dent in it? Or do you feel like, hey, you know what, we're making every day there's a victory and it just ebbs and flows?
It really ebbs and flows. I mean, there are days when I'll get texts from residents saying, like, oh my gosh, the neighborhood looks amazing, you know, and then I'll go into work on Monday morning and I'm like, did it? but it goes back and forth. And I mean, our clean team is incredible. They work, you know, they start early in the morning and they're out there power washing and cleaning and doing some really hard work. And I don't at all want to minimize what they do, but I think they do an incredible job. There's just so much of a job to do.
Right. So. I think you both hit on the fact that the problems that affect the Tenderloin are just bigger than the Tenderloin. I mean, the drug use, the fentanyl use, the lack of supportive housing for people. And the Tenderloin is uniquely and almost singularly suffering from those problems. I mean, just all these problems seem to congregate there. So with the time that we have left, I wanted to ask you both, what's going to move the needle and pull the Tenderloin out of this morass that it's in? And I'll start with you, Christy.
Thank you. I think there's two things. I think one is the rest of the city has to start taking responsibility, building housing. We can't have all of the supportive housing in District 6, you know, concentrated in the Tenderloin south of Market. And I think we just need to, and all of the services concentrated really in the Tenderloin. I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is now getting residents to a point where they feel comfortable enough to come out and activate the space. If it's okay, I'd like to share a few things actually coming up this week.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
We have a lot of, there's like all kinds of stuff happening in the Tenderloin this week. On Thursday, April 7th from 5 to 8, there's going to be a Dodge Place block party. And Dodge Place is just a little alley off of Turk and Larkin. And we're hoping, TLCBD is hoping to turn the alley into like a garden, like a parkway.
Wow.
And so we're going to kind of have like an imagine what this can be with outdoor dining, with Shovels Bar, which is right there, an urban gardening workshop and a DJ. So that's on Thursday. And then Friday is a spring family fest that's at the Salvation Army Croc Center, but it's in coordination with like all of the Tenderloin CBOs. There's 826 Valencia, Safe House Arts, Boys and Girls Club, TLCBD. There's going to be like an egg hunt and free books and an egg design contest, a photo booth, all kinds of fun stuff. That's for families. That's
well,
April 8th.
And can people go to attend? Can they help out?
Yeah.
Can they help you out?
I think we're good on volunteers, but they can absolutely show up definitely with their kids. Dodge Place block party, just come and hang out and see what it could be. And then Sunday Streets is April 10th, Sunday, and that's 11 to 4. And we're the first Sunday Streets in the city this year. So we have the route is basically Golden Gate, Larkin, and Ellis. And so people, I don't know if they're taking volunteers still, but Livable City runs that, and they have all of the volunteer forms on their website.
Well, it's a party in the Tenderloin, and sadly we've run out of time. But I really want to thank you for both of you for elucidating the issues and the wins. As Dr. Miller said, you know, we got to celebrate the wins. We've been talking to Dr. Lena Miller. She's the CEO of Urban Alchemy, working in the Tenderloin. Thank you, Dr. Miller, for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've had Christy Schirillo. She's with the Tenderloin Benefit Community District. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
And coming up next, we'll be hearing an interview with my co-host, Ethan Elkind. He's talking to Erin Gleason about Forest Feast Road Trip, her new cookbook. Stay tuned.
For years, author, illustrator, and photographer Erin Gleason has been teaching home cooks how to prepare delicious California-style vegetarian meals with her blog and her Forest Feast series of cookbooks. Recently, she and her family took an extended road trip around California, staying in unique cabin dwellings along the way, and she documented this journey in her new book, Forest Feast Road Trip, Simple Vegetarian Recipes Inspired by My Travels Through California. Each chapter focuses on a different region of the state, depicted in beautiful photographs, watercolor drawings, and recipes drawn from the fresh local produce that she found in each location. So I'm so glad to have the chance to sit down with Erin today to hear about her family's journey and her new cookbook. Erin Gleason, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the new cookbook. As I mentioned, this is the latest in a series of cookbooks that you've created. You also have a popular blog as well, but I was interested to learn that your background isn't actually in cooking. It's in art and photography. So can you explain how you got into cooking blog and then ultimately cookbooks?
Yeah, sure. So I studied art and photography. I did an MFA in photography when I was living in New York. And while I was in school, I became really interested in shooting food. And I was volunteering a lot as a photographer for the James Beard Foundation. And I was just kind of taking different photos as an art project that became my thesis for a local pastry chef, and ended up doing this kind of art book cookbook. And fast forward a couple of years, my husband got a job in California and we moved to a little cabin in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And suddenly I had left my freelance photography career behind and wanted to kind of restart. And as a way of making a portfolio, I started a blog. It was on Tumblr. Remember Tumblr?
Oh, yeah.
And I started just posting photos of food that I was taking. Everything was very much inspired by the farm box that we got weekly. So colorful local produce, all from the Bay Area or grown nearby. And I had always worked with chefs before who had made the dishes that I photographed, but this was the first time that I was making things myself. And I'm very much a home cook. The things that I was making were very simple, and they still are. Few ingredients, focusing on color, simple preparation, but very fresh and California produce inspired.
Well, and the color really pops with your photography backgrounds. But I'm curious about this travelogue of a journey that you took across California. What inspired you to go on this road trip? You also took along your two young children. So this was a big commitment. And I'm just curious how it came about for you.
Yeah. So my first three books are all about feeling inspired by cooking at a cabin in the woods. My fourth book was based on an extended family trip that we took around the Mediterranean. And I think we wanted to take the idea of cooking in a cabin on the road. And since we had little kids, road tripping seemed like a good idea. I was actually pregnant with the third baby for much of the traveling around Wow. California. I'm from California. My husband grew up in New York. So he wanted to, you know, see more places in California. And I realized that even though I camped a lot with my family growing up and traveled a lot around California, there was still a lot I hadn't seen. So we just wanted to take trips from our house and see what we could explore and find.
Yeah. So how did you choose the locations and any highlights that really stood out for you?
So the basis of the book is one big 3-week road trip, starting at our house in Woodside, California, traveling south down the one, all the way down to LA, up through the Eastern Sierras, back over the top of California, going through Lassen, over to Humboldt, and then back down the one. So this is the first book where I've featured pictures of the different cabins and cabin-like places that we've stayed. We stayed in a yurt on an urban farm in LA. We stayed in an A-frame in Big Bear. We stayed in an octagonal cabin house in Tahoe, a tent cabin in the Eastern Sierras on a lavender farm. So there's pictures of each of these places, and the recipes are very much inspired by the markets that we went to, you know, near these places that we'd stayed, and things we saw growing and restaurants we visited. And so just trying to highlight different regions kind of north to south.
Well, it's such a great love letter to just the diversity and beauty of California. That's part of the real pleasure in looking through the book. But we should talk, of course, about the food. And
yeah,
it looks spectacular. I know that our producer for the segment was able to cook a few of these dishes and reported very positive things about it. But I'm curious if you can describe a bit about what your philosophy is, if any, that guides you when you're creating these recipes.
So all the recipes in my books are vegetarian, and they're very simple. A lot of them have 5 ingredients or fewer, and I'm starting with produce. So trying to look for what's in season and what's colorful, and thinking of kind of artful ways to combine different ingredients, and also interesting and new but simple ways to cut things so that they look pretty on the plate. Because again, I'm coming from that kind of visual photography background, working as kind of like a photo stylist and food photographer. And so I want things to look colorful and pretty, not only because I think it's fun to prepare it that way, but I think it's also really kind of heightens the experience when you're eating it.
That's great. Well, so any recipes from Forest Feast that are particular favorites of yours or that you'd want to highlight now for listeners?
Sure. So as we were traveling, I took notes on all the different places that we visited. And then I came back to our house, to our cabin, and reworked them. For example, we visited a ranch near Santa Barbara, and when we were there, all the apricot trees were full. So we picked apricots. And the next morning, I was staying at my aunt and uncle's beach house in Santa Barbara, which is also featured in the book. And we often make breakfast burritos when we're there. And we needed salsa. So I said, why don't we use some of these apricots and chop them up and mix them into the salsa? So that apricot salsa dish ended up in the book. Another recipe, I've had a shortbread recipe in each of the books. And after staying on the lavender farm in the Eastern Sierras, which was just a magical stop, it wasn't even planned. We happened to find it the day before on the map and called up, and they happened to have a cabin for rent that night. And so we stopped at this lavender farm, which was run by an amazing woman. She gave us a tour of the whole farm that she'd built herself. She let us pick eggs from her coop, and we picked lavender, and we picked plums from her tree. And with the lavender, I brought that home, and I ended up adding it to my shortbread recipe, which now appears in the book. And that's something that she told me that she likes to do. She likes to bake with her lavender. So that was kind of a fun addition.
Yeah. So you're just gathering interesting ideas and resources from all over the state. And I noticed you also have some really good drink recipes. Any standouts there you want to talk about?
I think one of my favorites was inspired by a stop in an old gold rush town of Bodie. There's a gold miner cocktail that is bourbon with some citrus. I feel like citrus, we would see it just everywhere, trees full of lemons and oranges. So there's lemon and orange squeezed into the cocktail with some bourbon. And then to make it fancy and to make it inspired by California gold rush, you can buy little small bottles of gold flakes. And you can just put a couple flakes on top of your ice cubes before you take a sip, and it kind of makes it a little bit more fun.
Yeah, very nice. Well, we're almost at the cocktail hour with this, with State of the Bay when we air, so hopefully that's inspiring for listeners. And I mentioned you brought along your children, and I think for a lot of people raising kids, that's one of the challenges. How do you get your kids to be more adventurous in what they eat? So I'm wondering if you have any tips for how to get parents to overcome picky eaters.
I feel like our kids are picky like lots of kids. I think one of the big things is involving them in the preparation of the meal, which isn't always easy, especially on busy weeknights. But one of the things that we made a lot over the last couple of years, just for our family dinners, is bean and cheese taquitos. So I ended up putting spaghetti squash taquitos in the book, and the kids love helping me make those. We put the ingredients out on the cutting board, and they get up there and they roll the taquitos and we fry them up. And that's one of the only ways I can get them to eat beans.
So what's the next Forest Feast project involved?
So I'm taking a little bit of a pause. I'm working on some Forest Feast products, like some table linens. So there's a lot of my artwork in the book. They're kind of like artwork cookbooks. I overlay my watercolor illustrations on top of the photos, and my handwriting is incorporated. So I'm using some of the combination of the photography and the watercolors to create these floral patterns that I'm having printed on fabric, and I'm working on some table linens. So I'm kind of doing that as a separate project for now. And I'm also in the process of pitching a vegetarian cooking show, which I'm excited about. So taking a little pause to work on those two things. But if I were to do another book, which I hope to, people keep asking me for a vegan book. And I'm not vegan, but a lot of the recipes in my books are vegan. And I think that could be a fun challenge.
Right. Well, we're going to have to stay tuned for all that. And for listeners that want to see more of the recipes and the books, you can follow Erin Gleason's blog and find information about the cookbooks at theforestfeast.com. We'll also put a link on our State of the Bay page at kaw.org. But Erin Gleason, thanks so much for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. I'm Grace Wan, and I want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kaw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at any time at stateofthebay@kaw.org. Next Monday, we're talking about aging in the Bay Area. Tonight's show was produced by Sydney Bernier and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Joanne Moore was our board operator. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night. Thanks for listening.